for a newsletter there. This episode was reported by our senior producer, Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Kim Wheeler, producer of Canada Land Back, writer and producer on last year's Buffy St. Marie's Star Walker concert special, and host of The Kim Wheeler Show on SiriusXM's The Indigiverse. Thanks for joining me from Winnipeg.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
Today on the show, the most seismic and divisive expose in an alleged pretendian maybe ever? Certainly in the last decade at least. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Just to note that this episode's first segment contains a discussion of alleged sexual assault against a minor.
On this edition of The Fifth Estate, a Canadian icon whose true identity is in doubt.
I don't understand how in the face of all of those details, you continue to tell a story that has no basis in reality.
I want to update you on some questions that are going to be raised in the media about my truth and my ancestry, and I want to ensure you hear it from me first. These questions hurt me. They still do. But they also hurt others. They're questions I've struggled with my whole life. So what can I say now? I know who I am. I know who I love and who loves me. And I know who claims me. And to those who question my truth, I say with love, I know who I am.
As of recording, there have been 186 edits to the Buffy St. Marie Wikipedia page since the start of this year. But nearly two-thirds of those have come since last Friday, when the CBC's The Fifth Estate aired an episode and published an accompanying article rewriting, or at least raising questions about, much of what we thought we knew about one of the most prominent Indigenous individuals this land has ever produced, including whether, in fact, this land indeed produced her.
Here's Canadian legend
Buffy St. Marie.
The investigation consisted of two main components. One was a review of dozens of published accounts of her identity and origins across a 62-year span, from a 1961 report in the Springfield Republican to a September 2023 guest appearance on the Jan Arden podcast, which, taken together, offered shifting and sometimes quite contradictory narratives of her background, in some cases within a short period. That alone would raise my eyebrow, but I accept that, like, you know, like with like Bob Dylan, for example, there are multiple feature-length films celebrating his mutable identity and ultimate unknowability. So we set that aside. But the other bigger part was the CBC's examination of records.
We spent months hunting for documents, trying to uncover the truth.
Of a Stoneham, Massachusetts birth certificate issued in 1941, of a life insurance policy from 1945, a U.S. Census from 1950, her brother's statement of his personal history upon his military enrollment in 1956, her own marriage certificate from 1982, and several letters her brother wrote in the 70s to newspapers and family members, as well as a legal threat seemingly issued to him on her behalf. There were also interviews with St. Marie's niece, cousin, and sister, all of which together suggested that the white Italian-American family she had often described herself as being adopted into was in fact her biological family. St. Marie did not give an interview to the CBC for the story, though she did respond with a gently threatening lawyer's letter in September, and then the day before publication, after rumors of the impending story had reached a fever pitch, released her own statement to both written and video forms, pointing out, among other things, that as a young adult, she was adopted by individual members of the Paiapot First Nation in accordance with Cree law and customs.
I also found a new family, a chosen family. And they took me in as an adult in accordance with Cree law and traditions, and they claimed me as their own.
And I do have to say that on the whole, I found the CBC's reporting on balance to be more convincing than not. But I understand that you see it a bit differently, Kim.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of holes in that story. You know, you talk about the birth certificate, the marriage certificate, the brother, the family. And as a 60 Scoop adoptee myself, I can tell you that I have two birth certificates. I have the birth certificate that came from when I was adopted that names my white parents. And I have a second birth certificate that I didn't find until last year. And by find, I mean I went to the, I can't remember if it was through the post-adoption agency. It was some agency, some government organization here in Manitoba where I had to apply to get my birth records. So then I have that second live birth or birth certificate with my birth mother's name on it. And so when they say, oh, well, she signed her marriage certificate, it's like, well, what was she supposed to do, right? I mean, she had to have said she had a birthday at some point. My date of birth is February 7th. But when I met my birth family, my sisters thought my birth date was February 10th. And that's what they lived with all their lives. The other thing that the CBC, the Fifth Estate, didn't mention when they talked about her family was that this was an estranged family. This was a family that she had no contact with, that she met that cousin one time when he was a small child. And I don't know if she's actually ever met the niece. So those little words that are missing are really important when it comes to a story of this importance, because it will sway the audience one way or the other. It's like, oh, well, her family is saying this. Well, actually, it's her estranged family. And I, you know, I would hope that the viewing public is smart enough to pick up on all of those. In this instance, I don't think they were, because it's such an emotional story.
I mean, it is interesting, especially for a TV piece, the extent to which it relied on documentary evidence. I mean, obviously we can and should debate, you know, the merits of each of those pieces. But I think perhaps because of this absence, they did put an emphasis on that. I went through the written piece, and which has a little bit more in the way of just mentioning specific articles and things than the TV piece does. And I'm just curious exactly, like, who did they interview and who did they not? And who did they specifically also, who did they say they tried to reach out to and didn't respond? And there was less of that than I expected. So the people with whom they did interviews, as indicated in the article, are two academics, Kim Tolbert and Jean Tay. There are three family members, Heidi St. Marie, the niece, Lainey, her sister, Bruce Santa Maria, her cousin, who you mentioned having met him her once, two American researchers / activists, Jacqueline Keeler and Doug Buchholz, and Maria Sagarino, the town clerk in Stoneham, Massachusetts, who, quite surprising for people for us in Canada who are used to trying to, you know, squeeze any kind of statement out of public officials about anything, was very forthright and assertive in, you know, from a TV perspective, very good sound bites and very good quotes about how confident she was in the validity of the records.
Yeah, so is it, am I understanding this right? Her name is Buffy St. Marie now?
Yeah, right.
And she's a folk singer?
Yeah.
And she says she was born in Canada?
Yeah.
And that these people adopted her?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not true.
Yeah.
I can say absolutely with 100% certainty that this is the original birth certificate. Beverly Jean Santa Maria was born in Stoneham, Massachusetts at New England Sanitarium and Hospital on February 20th, 1941. She was not born in Canada. And if anybody is saying otherwise, then they're misinformed.
And there are about 40 different articles mentioned. And then the whole bunch of documentary evidence.
Right. Well, when we talk articles, though, right, when we talk articles like the media stories, we know how wrong the media gets stories. Even to this present day, how wrong the media can get little facts that can, you know, change over time and change somebody's identity.
One of the things I found interesting was certainly the lead up to the piece actually being published, where, you know, word got out, you know, CBC had on the TV schedule, the episode called Making an Icon, they're going to look into the claims of Indigenous identity of a particular high-profile person, not specified whom. Word got out pretty quickly that it was Buffy St. Marie, and there was a lot of maybe initial reaction before it was published. When did you first hear that CBC was working on something?
I first heard of it last May. And actually, actually, it was Drew Hayden Taylor who brought it to my attention, because he had been approached by Jacqueline Keeler, who is in the documentary, who was looking for somebody who would report on this story in Canada. And because Drew did the documentary, The Pretendians, she thought he would be a good person, but he declined. And so he had copies of the birth certificate and the and a couple of the photos. So he had shown me them. And rightly or wrongly, I didn't say anything really to anybody outside of my immediate circle about it, because I honestly thought that they would go down this rabbit hole and not find anything substantial. Well, I guess I was wrong, and that's okay. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's up to each of us to believe what we're going to believe.
Setting aside, I guess, your conclusions on the merits of the findings, do you believe it was a worthwhile story for them to do in the first place?
Yeah. As a journalist, I always think that if you're presented with something that sheds doubt on someone, and especially in this age where we are pretendian hunting, that it is worth looking into. Knowing what they found and how they presented it, I wouldn't have presented it that way. I would have presented a more balanced, nuanced approach. You know, you mentioned off the top about Cree law and speaking to the Piapot family. Like, unless you get the Piapot family on camera, and unless you get a Cree knowledge keeper and you discuss Cree law, and instead of just taking the word of the clerk at the birth records registry in Massachusetts, why didn't they speak to a historian? I mean, this story is, well, you know, while I know there are really important pressing issues in the world right now, this story is of national importance, and it has torn the Indigenous community apart. There are people who are losing friends. There are people who are on both sides of the fence. Natanas Piapot, who is on the Piapot family statement, has received threats. And I just think, you know, we should be able to move through this with grace and kindness and understanding and not be laterally violent towards one another.
What do you think has informed the different ways that people have reacted? I mean, obviously, many people are still have sort of this maybe a cautious approach of still learning the ambiguity of not knowing. But as you noted, many people feel very strongly one way or the other. Have you found any sort of common determining factors of where someone tends to fall?
No, I don't think so. But I do know that, and unfortunately as it is, that we are really happy to tear people down very quickly. You know, not just as a society, but as Indigenous people as well. Back in the 90s, we called it crabs in the bucket syndrome. As one reaches the top, the others are there to whip them, you know, pull them back down. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we are so quick to jump on people and to, you know, say all of these things that, oh, I always wondered why she had, you know, a weird skin tone, or she probably dyes her hair black. I'm like, well, where were you guys before? Like, why weren't you saying this previously when the Carry It On documentary came out, when the Star Walker show came out? Like, I didn't hear any of those negative comments. Everybody was like, oh, Buffy, Buffy, Buffy. And now there's question around her identity, and they're all like, I always knew it.
One of the points the Fifth Estate makes is that there hadn't been more discussion around it, certainly from the people who, from her family, people who knew her since childhood, was because she had actively worked to suppress it. In the documentary, they show a lawyer's letter, a 1975 letter from Abraham Sommer of Mitchell, Silberberg, and Krupp, addressed to her now late brother, basically warning him that she will sue if he continues doing things that would interfere with her employment prospects. And this apparently came shortly after he had a chance encounter with a potential employer of hers on Sesame Street, where she was eventually hired and was a cast member for several years, and who it later called him up to confirm some, just to confirm, like, is she indigenous or not? And he said, no, she's white, like me. And so there was this, you know, this threatening letter that amazingly her brother and then his daughter had apparently kept in the original envelope, along with the another handwritten letter from her, seemingly from her. The CBC actually did a handwriting analysis to see if it was from her, in the same envelope, threatening to dredge up other things, other accusations, should he continue.
Right.
And that per letters he then sent to his parents, he said, like, you know, screw it, it's not worth it. So that's an explanation it offers. But and to me, that also is one of the things that makes me question it in terms of responding, sort of going to legal threats. But I guess, what did you make of that part?
Well, you know, what she said was that she would move forward with the, and make it, I guess, public knowledge that he had sexually abused her when she was a child and abused her.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like when women come forward with allegations of sexual abuse or abuse, and people go, oh, that can't possibly happen, we're going down a really slippery slope, right? Women should say something. Then it's like, well, don't believe women. So I don't understand why people would even question whether she was or wasn't, because now they're thinking, oh, well, she's accusing him because he wanted to out her. But what if he really did sexually abuse her?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to believe women regardless.
Yeah. I mean, in my view, the state does raise questions about it, but I also don't, about the accusation. I think it makes a point of not making a determination on that, or at least not making a determination nearly as strong as the one it makes about her identity. And I think it at least tries to make a point of leaving ambiguity. Maybe even leaving ambiguity may not be the best or most respectful path there. But the letter itself from the lawyer did make reference to specifically interference with employment opportunities, and that she would dredge these things up if that were the case. And I guess, without litigating the validity of those, of the accusations around abuse, because I certainly don't have the information around that, and the documentary doesn't present enough information to draw any firm conclusions, it does say, Miss St. Marie has advised that you have, without provocation, disparaged and perhaps defamed Buffy and maliciously interfered with her employment opportunities. We've been instructed to advise you that should you persist in this course of conduct, we are to initiate whatever legal remedies we deem appropriate, although it alludes to the alleged abuse. It very much connects it. It very much leads off with, we've heard that you're interfering in her employment opportunities. If that persists, we will bring this out. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say one way or the other that did not happen, but that the fact, the precipitating element seems to have been discussion. It seems to have been discussion of her identity. And it's really awkward, as these things tend to be, that these things have become entangled in this document, in this documentary, in that interview, in that discussion.
I mean, they made the Fifth Estate piece so black and white that there is just some basic questions. If they would have just asked, maybe I would have felt more settled on their reporting. It's very one-sided. The story is incredibly one-sided. If they would have talked to the Piapot family, if they would have talked to a Cree knowledge keeper, if they would have talked to a historian, I may be sitting here feeling very different about the entire piece.
Now that this is out there and there's a lot of division about how, in terms of how it's been received, I guess, what do you think or hope will happen next? How does this discussion move forward from here?
Well, I hope that we as a community can move forward respectfully and gracefully and with kindness and understanding how each of us feel, even if it is on completely different sides of the fence. You know, the Indigenous music community has worked so incredibly hard over the last, 15 years, building this community and raising one another up. And they, a lot of them acknowledge that they stand on the shoulders of giants, including Buffy St. Marie, who opened doors for them. And I hope that this does not do anything to ruin friendships, ruin collaborations, and ruin the community that they've built so hard. to make and to break into non-Indigenous audiences and venues, and that, you know, while, yes, we are hurting and there's a lot of pain, I hope that we can move past this and continue the good work that Indigenous musicians are doing today.
Another heads up that in Kim's Duly Noted, there will be a discussion of suicide. So Kim, on this show, we like to duly note things. I'd like to note duly something that was kind of foreseeable. That the Shortcuts episode I recorded 2 weeks ago with Basant Matar on the subject of Gaza and Israel would become the subject of an action alert from Honest Reporting Canada. Honest Reporting Canada, as we described in that episode, is the sort of the premier advocacy organization that systematizes pressure to, as they say at the top of their site, ensure fair and accurate Canadian media coverage of Israel. They monitor for items whose framing or word choices they take issue with, write a blog post about it, and blast alerts to a subscriber list of what they say is almost 60,000 people. And those blog posts often contain forms that auto-generate emails to the news organization or other institutions they're attempting to hold accountable. As its executive director, Mike Fagelman, told the Jewish News Syndicate a few months ago, "We want to create a digital army for Israel." And so this past Sunday, they published a post called "Candleland Podcast Guest Claims 75 Years of Israeli Occupation, Denying Israel's Right to Exist," by Robert Walker, a former communications director for the Israeli Embassy and digital brand manager for retirementhomes.com, who is now Honest Reporting's assistant director. While the post discussed both Basant and myself, it featured a photo of just her, and this was similar to the previous occasion they took issue with the Shortcuts I hosted, in which that graphic also highlighted just the woman journalist of color who joined me on it. And actually, if you were to go by the images on their site, you can conclude there's actually a healthy level of diversity in Canadian media. In the past 3 months, from August 1st through October 31st, they've published 19 posts whose lead graphic prominently features an image of a journalist whose reporting or commentary they took issue with. All but three of those are women, and two-thirds are women of color. But I'm bringing this up because of the insight it's offered in terms of how their form letters actually work in practice on the receiving end. So the post went up Sunday, and all of Monday I was wondering who at Candleland was actually getting bombarded. No one seemed to know, and so I tried to test one myself, replacing their default message with a request that, you know, whoever receives the email, please forward it back to me so I can just find out where it ended up. But then Monday night at 8:36 p.m., they all came through in a single dump. 381 identical emails across the span of just a couple minutes to our general editor at candleland.com inbox. But because we use a Gmail-based platform for our company email accounts, this made much less of a dent than I would have guessed. Because all the messages had an identical subject line, "Stop giving a platform to those who deny Israel's right to exist," Gmail just sorted them into a handful of threads of about 100 messages each, meaning it occupied just four lines of the inbox. And then another 74 came through on Wednesday afternoon, including all those where the suggested body text was modified, including the test one that I sent. So it was a lot of messages, but thanks to Gmail, not really a disruptive onslaught. The other thing I learned is that all the emails were identified as coming from the address civicinput@newmode.org. I looked up Newmode and discovered it's an advocacy platform that makes a point of marketing itself as a backer of progressive causes. For example, its homepage spotlights a campaign opposed to the Coastal GasLink pipeline through Wet'suwet'en territory, and they highlight clients like the United Steelworkers, Greenpeace, and Sunrise Movement. They even have a set of principles that says, "We won't work with aggressive forces. Newmode subscribers are not permitted to promote things like the limitation of civil, democratic, or minority rights, policies that have been demonstrated to significantly reduce public health, or violence, warfare, or colonization." So I reached out to Newmode to ask, like, you know, what does violence, warfare, colonization mean in the context of their policy and how they believed Honest Reporting Canada's mission and campaigns align with their principles. They go back to me to say that, you know, as a values-based company, we believe technology is not neutral, but rather should be leveraged for the general good of people, communities, and the environment. We take this seriously through strong values-based content requirements in our terms of service and responsive moderation. They use a detailed rubric to assess potential violations, the penalties for which can range from a notice to the subscriber, content removal, or subscription termination. But they do not comment on the terms of service reviews that may be ongoing for a particular subscriber.
Duly noted.
Kim, what would you like to note, Julie, today?
Well, mine is really sad, actually.
And I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the story of an 11-year-old girl in Sioux Lookout who took her own life. And the Kingfisher Lake First Nation did do a news release on October 29th and named her. Her name is Elena Cecilia Nancy Beardy. Tanya Talaga, who's a columnist, an Anishinaabe columnist for the Globe and Mail, actually included her in one of her columns maybe like the same day or the day after, she was talking about the Buffy St. Marie story, but said, well, that is going on. The story of the suicide of this young girl has been missed. And in a quick Google search, yes, Tanya is the only one who had covered her death. Why are we not talking about that? That 11-year-old little kids in this country are so, you know, I don't know what they're going through, that they would think that death is the only way out for them. Why is this country not talking about that? The Anishinaabe Aski Nation Grand Chief Alvin Fiddler also retweeted the news release with her death. And I just want to read to you, you know, what they said. So, of course, they said, you know, she leaves behind her parents and her maternal grandparents. And they say all this. But this is the little blurb that they wrote about Elena. Elena was always a happy young lady, always had a ready smile for everyone. She was always willing to lend a helping hand, especially to her friends that she left behind. We called her Princess Elena, or Baby, because that was who she was with us. She loved everyone around her. Princess Elena will be forever missed and will be forever in our hearts. You know, with all this news that's going on in the world and the things that are happening right here in this country, even last week, you know, the Supreme Court announced that Canada owes the, you know, First Nations $23 billion for child welfare. Even that story should have been at the top of the news cycles, but it wasn't. And even though the media covered it, it was lost among all the Buffy noise, especially when it came to my feed, that Indigenous people were just talking about Buffy. So these two incredibly important stories have gotten lost under the story of the validity of Buffy St. Marie's identity.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that's reminders that sometimes it's not that the media is a zero-sum game, but sometimes it kind of is.
Yeah, like how do you go back and get the media interested and the public interested in talking about the $23 billion again? Because they'll say, well, we did that story last week. What's new this week? Well, I'm sure there's lots of new things this week and lots of angles that can be covered because we're still talking about the Buffy story, right? 5 days later.
Duly noted. That's Surf Cuts this week. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. We're on the platform formerly known as Twitter at CanadaLand. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com and read everything you send. And you can also look up my last name, Goldsby, on Blue Sky. Where can people find you, Kim?
They can find me on X at Kimmage Wheeler. And I'm accepting new friends on Facebook these days.
Oh, wow. This episode is produced by Viva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Ned Ejofo. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.